When Dan Hesse left Sprint in 2014, he promised himself a year completely off from work. That year has expired, and Dan Hesse is back at it. And he's right here in our studios this morning to tell us what he's learned in his year away. In his years as Sprint CEO, he won a slew of awards, including Kansas City's Best CEO in a readership poll by Ingram's Magazine, while Glassdoor named him one of America's highest-rated CEOs by employees. For Dan's last two full calendar years as CEO, Sprint's total shareholder return ranked number one among all S&P 500 companies. He's considered one of the most influential people when it comes to mobile technology. And Dan, welcome back to the show. It's so nice to have you here.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Why did you promise yourself one year completely off after you left Sprint, Dan? And what did you learn in that time away?
Well, I'd been accused by many people of being a serial workaholic. And so, you know, I worked very hard for 37 years, and I had really, if you think of it, I tried to have a balanced life, but I really focused primarily on being the best leader and mentor I could be, and I wanted to take some time to be the best father, husband, son, and friend that I could be. And if I didn't take the year completely off, if I just started one thing, I knew it was all over. I would get back into it. And a number of things I learned. Number one is, you know, I felt as though I always dealt with stress pretty well. I didn't feel as though I was stressed out at all. But when I stopped working, I realized that I was carrying around a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very different feeling. So, for example, and the way it kind of I knew that is I could be having this conversation with you, but in the back of my mind, if I was running Sprint, I would be thinking about what I'm doing at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock today, what's due tomorrow.
Yeah.
And now I live very much in the moment. It was interesting. I talked to a number of CEOs about retirement, and they said it'll be interesting. What you'll find out is who your real friends are.
Ah.
Because, you know, you have these great business associations and friendships and partnerships that you build up over time. And you think everybody really likes you for being you.
Mm-hmm.
And what you learn is, you know, who really likes you for being you and who likes you because you were the CEO of Sprint or Embark or AT&T Wireless or what have you.
Well, how hard was it for a self-described serial workaholic to step on the brakes a little bit? I mean, did you go through to phase it in a little bit or not?
Yeah, the first few months were difficult and tough. I mean, I was enjoying it, but I had this drive, this antsiness. And that gradually went away. Now, I did a lot of things. What I did is not only spent a lot of time doing things I loved. So I went to all my high school son's home games and away games.
Mm-hmm.
My college son visited him a lot, did a lot of things with my wife. I have passions that I care a lot about, music, went to a lot of music festivals, visited a lot of wineries, a lot of sporting events.
Sounds
nice.
But
also gave a lot of, you know, interviews and talks. So, you know, Wednesday I go give a talk at MIT. I'll be up at Notre Dame in a few weeks giving a talk there. A number of speeches in New York, interviews. Forbes interviewed me on everything but from Pope Francis to the Kansas City Royals.
Well, speaking of that, one of the things they interviewed you about was the Royals and the Royals' success the last couple of years. And you talked with Forbes about what CEOs can learn from a team like the Kansas City Royals. What are the lessons that the Royals might bestow upon big leaders in this country?
Well, you know, one of the really nice things about that article was I got a call from David Glass.
Oh, really?
Saying, I read your article and you nailed it.
Oh, that's great.
Which you know, means a lot to me because he's just done such a fabulous job as really the leader, or you could say chairman and CEO of that organization. I think number one, they take a long-term view. You know, people forget,
unlike the rest of the sports world.
Absolutely. And the business world, because it's managed quarter to quarter. And those companies that take a long-term view, that have a vision, tend to be much better off. And a lot of people forget that Dayton Moore's first 8 years were losing seasons. And then he started to win. He built the team from the ground up. There was a certain chemistry he looked for. He looked for character in his players, honesty, integrity. The players also knew that Dayton Moore and Yost and the Glasses really cared about them as people, not just players.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of those kinds of examples that can be directly correlated to what makes CEOs and companies successful.
Why do you think the Royals were able to take the long-term view? Because maybe that's the big question here. At a time when, what have you done for me lately? What have you won lately? What's the latest quarterly report show as it pertains to the business world? Why could the Royals sit back and sort of do it a different way?
Well, I think it's just what, you know, when the Glasses hired Dayton Moore and then he went and got Ned Yost, that's what they decided and agreed to do. Especially
he told him up front. Dayton told him up front, this is going to take some time.
This is going to take some time. And particularly, for example, building a farm system, which is, if you take a look at the key players of the Royals, they weren't free agents because as a small market team,
yeah,
you don't have the revenues that the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Dodgers have. You can't go win by spending a gazillion dollars on a whole bunch of free agents.
Yeah.
You have to bring them up because of, you know, basically your financial situation. And they knew that would take time. And they did it. And you take a look at, you know, Hosmer, Moustakas, Gordon, you go right down the list. They were drafted and came up through the farm system, and not that many teams can do that. So it really was the vision of the owner and the GM.
You're a big Royals fan. I see pictures of you with the different players. I've seen them on Facebook or wherever I've seen them. I'm not sure where, but you clearly love this team.
I do. I've always loved baseball. I played baseball. Both my boys play baseball. I've loved the Royals. I just like everything about them.
Yeah.
There's just nothing like going out to the ballpark.
There's nothing like that, is there? Yeah. And it's like it's that time of year again, and everybody can't wait to go back out.
And what I like about the team, and it's I think a lot of it is Dayton Moore's character. I mean, they say, you know, there's no I in the word team.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real superstars on this team. A lot of really good players. But they talk about just keeping the line moving.
Yeah.
Everybody just move a batter over one base, the next guy will pick you up. And actually, some would argue it's the great team for the post-steroid era, because you don't have as many home runs. Small ball becomes a lot more important.
Former Sprint CEO Dan Hesse is my guest. Let's turn to the mobile internet, Dan, because you're one of the great experts in this whole area. You've said that when internet browsers were put into cell phones around 2007, that it was like peanut butter meeting chocolate. Mm-hmm. Just a great metaphor. You've said that wireless's next big growth spurt will not be driven by cell phones. So where are we going to see it? Where's the next big growth for wireless going to be?
Well, in what they call the Internet of Things, if you think of the growth in wireless, there are really three phases. The first phase was people talking to people. I mean, they were used for phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, I have two teenage boys who don't use them for phone calls, but that's originally what it was for. then the peanut butter met chocolate when they put an internet browser in a phone, what they call the smartphone, and people remember like the first iPhone back in that 2006, 2007 period of time, wireless growth took off again, where people didn't use it so much to talk to other people, but to have access to information, browse the web, and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
The third phase is the Internet of Things, which started a few years ago. And that's where people really aren't in the equation at all. It's things talking to things. It's your smartwatch. It's your Fitbit. It's meters. It's connected cars. It's connected medical devices. And Cisco estimates there are 25 billion things connected to the Internet right now. And there'll be 50 billion in 5 years.
I'm not sure a lot of people have completely wrapped their arms around that idea, what you just said. Am I right?
Although there's a lot being invested in the Internet of Things, but no. And actually, one of the big issues about the Internet of Things is the amount of information that's being gathered all the time out there, and privacy.
About you and your preferences and what you like to, where you like to shop and what you like to eat, all that stuff.
Yes, and exactly, and where you are, and everything from cameras, you go right down the list, to your medical devices, how healthy you are, how your heartbeat is, all of these kinds of things. There's an awful lot of information. So this debate about privacy and security is also becoming much more important because there's so much more information about all of us that's out there.
One good thing you've pointed out is the way it could democratize education. Hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, years ago, if you weren't, let's say you were in high school and you wanted to take a class, an AP class in Russian literature, you either had to go to a big public school or a very good private school. Now you can get almost everything online. So regardless of your financial circumstances or where you are geographically, if you're in rural Kansas, you know, I have a small high school. I might want to take a class in electrical engineering or African art. I can go right on Khan Academy.
You got on recently and did a class on algebra to help one of your kids?
I did. So, you know, to help one of my sons, my high school son, with his algebra homework, you forget that. So I went on Khan Academy and brushed up. It was great.
It helped.
It helped a lot.
Yeah. And this is really going to change. I mean, but the potential here is just fascinating to me.
It is. But, you know, there's also a downside to it. And some would argue that it's creating potentially another digital divide. Actually, when my last year at Sprint, we worked with the administration on a program called Connect Ed, because with all of this education available online, a lot of kids don't have tablets. Or let's say there might be connection at school. They go home, they don't have a data plan. They don't have high-speed internet at home. They might not have a wireless device. So you want to make sure that doesn't happen either.
You hear a lot about the digital divide. Is it being addressed at the pace you think it should be addressed?
It's never fast enough, but I think it is being addressed. And of course, you know, communication technology gets less and less expensive all the time, and it gets to be higher and higher on people's priority lists. So wireless penetration, that's a good example. You go to the developing world where people are really poor. The one thing they have is a cell phone. The wireless phone is the most rapidly adopted technology in the history of humankind.
Hmm.
But, you know, on the educational front, you know, there are also some areas that we have to pay attention to. So cyberbullying, texting. Some people would say the quality of the written and the spoken word is going down. There's not as much communication and discourse. You go to a school cafeteria and the students aren't having a conversation. They're on their cell phones texting one another. I mean, if I want to talk to my sons or know what's going on, I typically text them. Mm-hmm. I don't call them. There was a study done of the grammar that teens use, and I think 64% of texts use improper grammar.
I'm seeing that a lot in communication studies, 303 WI. I teach up on the Hill here at UMKC. Introduction to journalism, you see it with alarming frequency these days, Dan.
You do. And, you know, there's other things that we just have to pay attention to. I was watching a CNN show with Anderson Cooper, and it was on these 12-year-olds, I believe, and their addiction to their cell phones and how miserable they were when you took it away. And there's a new word called FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. And wow. it's a big deal where kids feel they need to be checking what's being said about them and their friends, or something will happen that they don't know about. And it's become a bit of an addiction. So there are a lot of very positive things. The democratization of education, the amount of information that's out there, being able to search on anything, very, very positive. But we have to pay attention to how it's really changing, actually, even the wiring, if you will, that our kids have.
What about that notion? You've got young kids. I've got young kids. I mean, what about this whole idea of how much time they spend on the phone? I've never heard that phrase FOMO before, but that's clearly a dynamic out there that I've seen a million times with my own boys. What about that? What do we do about that?
Well, I think you have to try to, and it's hard to do, you know, limit the time that your sons and daughters spend on. And I know, good luck. It's just something I think we need to be vigilant about. But to mention wiring, the young generation is growing up a little bit differently, even as people. And there's some positives and there's some negatives. On the positive side, they're multitaskers.
Yeah.
I mean, you take young people, they can't like watch TV without also doing something else at the same time.
I find myself in sort of that same thing. I don't want to sit and watch a baseball game. I'll be reading the New York Times while I'm doing it. And it's a weird, I've noticed a change in myself.
Yep. And they've known nothing else. So from the time they were little, they are always multitasking, which is great. It's a great skill, great ability to have. But on the downside, studies have shown the generation doesn't have as much patience. They need instant gratification, perhaps not as much deep thought, reflection. You know, so there's pluses and minuses. I think many more positives than negatives, but, you know, there's no free lunch.
And maybe bottom line with all this is we really don't know what the impact of all this screen time is going to be. We've done shows on it here on Up to Date. We don't know what the impact is for sure. You talk about this changing dynamic, but where it's headed, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? But I think, you know, generally, I think it improves people's lives in many ways. Studies have shown that, like in developing countries, for each 10 percentage points in penetration, so if you go from 60% to 70% of the population having a cell phone, it adds a half a point to GDP growth. So GDP might go from 2 to 2.5%. Very good for the economy. Studies been done in the U.S. that 1.5 trillion of GDP will be contributed to the U.S. economy over the next 10 years because, you know, because of wireless. As someone who's getting older, I'm really looking forward, I have to admit, to a lot of elements of getting older because of this technology. Smart appliances, self-driving cars, personalized robots, which all use the mobile internet. All of this information about me using big data, smart algorithms, artificial intelligence, you know, robotics. It's a pretty exciting world where I can likely live in my home, plus social media and communication with the outside world, text to speech, speech to text. So if I start losing my sight, I can hear it rather than have to read it, and the other way around if it's hearing. I think it's going to improve the quality of life for the aging generation very significantly.
Time magazine's cover story this week on driverless cars. You know, clearly a new frontier for so many of us.
It is, and they're coming. I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, just like Uber is, which is basically a mobile app. Mm-hmm. Uber is revolutionizing transportation, and we were talking about electric cars earlier.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have driverless cars, and I think that's a good thing.
What about this next generation of wireless data that's coming down the pike too, Dan? 5G. What is it, and how is that going to change our lives?
Well, it means that data is just going to move faster and faster and become more economical. Generally, there's a half of an order of magnitude improvement in price performance with each G. So Gs are generations. A lot of people don't know that. 1G was analog.
Yeah.
2G was digital, when you had things like CDMA and GSM and when you started to get text messages. 3G was when the browsers went into the phones, the first iPhone, where at least networks were fast enough to browse, but not really fast enough, especially if you had data. Mm-hmm. I mean, lots of data and video. 4G, which is the state of the art now, was the first wireless networks that were fast enough to support data like YouTube. You can watch videos on your cell phone. Mm-hmm. 3G, you really can't. You need that 4G signal. 5G is just that much faster, like HD video, 4K video. Over networks.
And how far away are we from getting it?
Well, it's hard to say because the investments have just been made in 4G and wireless carriers are putting 4G networks in, and there hasn't been an accepted standard yet in 5G. You know, there's 5G technologies being studied and tried. I think about 3 years away, you'll start seeing 5G networks go in.
Because the demand for speed, as you would know as well as anyone on the planet, is just incredible, isn't it?
Oh, it is, and it's insatiable. And also they use spectrum more efficiently. Each generation gets, if you will, more, to use a wireless frame, more bits per hertz. So in a given amount of air, you know, there's spectrum. So there's this many, you know, this much frequency. With each generation, I can get more stuff through that air, you know, and that's important as well, because what's really driving the usage on wireless networks now is video.
Yeah.
And video is reshaping advertising. It's reshaping, you know, so much on mobile networks, and that's why 5G is necessary.
Let's do this, Dan. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with former Sprint CEO Dan Hesse. We're going to turn to cybersecurity, which is a threat to all of this new advances that Dan's talking about. We're also going to talk about music quality and Dan's relationship with a guy named Neil Young. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation about the life and times of Cole Porter or our discussion about area veteran treatment courts, you can find those at kcur.org/uptodate. On tomorrow's program, how the right to vote has always involved the fight to vote. We also examine what influences you to vote the way you do, and we'll have our latest edition of State House Blend. We're visiting now with former Sprint CEO Dan Hesse. Dan, I wanted to ask you about this burgeoning world of cybersecurity, but I also wanted to talk with you about Apple and its CEO Tim Cook, who is, everyone seems to know, is opposing a federal court order requiring it to help law enforcement officials break into an iPhone used by one of the attackers in last year's San Bernardino shootings. Is Tim Cook doing the right thing here by saying no to the federal government, Dan?
Well, it's a complex question. Yeah. I was quoted in a recent Wall Street Journal article, a speech I gave with the NSA chief, Admiral Rogers, last year on the issue of cyber. And Right. The question for CEOs I posed was, which CEO is more patriotic? The CEO who gives law enforcement every piece of information they have to help prevent a terrorist attack, catch a criminal, or the CEO who puts protections around, if you will, their products so that law enforcement can't get into it,
yeah,
believing that civil liberties is a higher calling.
Yeah.
I think both are right in many respects. Both are patriotic. I personally believe that, and I don't side with either the FBI or Apple in the case, but I think that it's good that Tim Cook is taking the position that he is, because all of what's happening now is based upon the All Writs Act of 1789. This is over 200 years ago, and technology has changed so much. I mean, this is decades before the telegraph was invented, for crying out loud.
So it's time for Congress to catch up with new laws here, you're saying.
That's my view, that this is so important, if you will, this balance between privacy and security and utility and national security, et cetera, that it's going to take the administration and Congress and the courts to really think about it, because there's going to be a lot of precedents set here, which Apple is right, that, you know, if Apple turns over, let's say, does this for the U.S. government, what are they going to say to the Russian government, the Chinese government? If they create a back door, which a back door doesn't exist, that's why the FBI can't get in.
Right.
If they create it, their belief is really smart hackers will find a way in and we all become less secure. These are legitimate issues and reasons. On the other hand, I think that, you know, the FBI has been very smart actually to pick a case where, you know, who doesn't want to know, you know, more about the San Bernardino killer? I mean, Everybody does, and that is important information. So I don't know where this will come out. I just think it's time that the laws catch up to technology.
And at least we're having a national debate about it. You and I are talking about it here. This is happening across the country right now.
That's the good part. Exactly. Yeah. You nailed it. Yeah. We need a debate about it.
Okay, cybersecurity then. Where do we stand here? What are your concerns about all of this, Dan? And what does the average consumer need to be worried about right now?
Well, I think, you know, as I look at cybersecurity, I talked about all the benefits of the mobile internet economically. It's actually, overall, it's a bit one of the negatives economically is all that we have to spend on, you know, on cybersecurity. The average company of 1,000 employees or more spends $9 million a year, and that investment is increasing at double the rate of their IT spend. But I also mentioned earlier the Internet of Things, where you have all of this information about us. Mm-hmm. A lot of it, though, from a utility point of view, is going to make our lives better. So, you know, I joined the board of a company, AdKnowledge.
I was going to ask you about
here in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. But what they do is, you know, advertising is moving from traditional television and newspaper gradually to more of it being digital, you know, on the internet and on your
phone. I've noticed at the Kansas City Star. That's come across my plate a few times. Yeah.
And what one would say is, boy, this makes a lot of sense. If you aren't going to see more advertising or less advertising on your computer or on your phone, but if it was relevant to you, you would find it less intrusive, more valuable. So, for example, instead of an ad on about pantyhose, I saw an ad about vinyl records.
Mm-hmm.
That would be more interesting to me, less intrusive, more valuable, more positive. The advertiser would pay more money, because advertising, that's how you keep rates low. For wireless service, your cable service, your internet service, they would pay more so your rates could be lower. Everybody's better off. The advertiser is better off. They're getting better return. They're paying more. Mm-hmm. The carrier's better off. You as an individual is better off. The concern is, do I want to let Apple or Google or Verizon know all this about me or my advertiser, you know, advertising companies? Mm-hmm. I think they're working very hard to protect that, if you will, privacy and increase utility, but particularly with your medical information. You have to be vigilant. Hackers are out there.
And to what extent are you worried about hackers out there and what they might mean for Dan Hesse's household and my household for that matter as well?
Well, I don't let it keep me up at night, mm-hmm. but I make sure that, for example, on my cell phone, I always lock it. Mm-hmm. I use things like Lookout, which is it's a cyber software that's very helpful. You know, so you password protect your devices. I never click on. I see a free Wi-Fi. You don't click on a Wi-Fi network you don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
You understand, you know, I get calls. This is Microsoft calling about, you know, your Windows. We need to upgrade this. A lot of phishing, a lot of scamming. You have to be very, you know, you ask them a few questions, a number of scams. You get a link on your computer, click on this. And it'll come from friends of yours because their accounts will be hacked. You just have to have a sense not to click that. So you just have to be very vigilant. There's a lot of education out there, but it's really up to each of us to protect ourselves against a cyber attack. And whether it's companies or individuals, it really comes down to being personally vigilant. It makes a big difference.
You mentioned your involvement serving on the boards of AdKnowledge and another company, PNC. Mm-hmm. Tell us about those companies and why did you get involved?
Well, so I took a year off and I, companies who were interested in having me serve on the board started reaching out to me when I retired from Sprint. I said, no, we'll start talking around the end of 2015 after a year is up. By the way, it's been 18 months since I left Sprint.
Yeah.
And the one thing about PNC was I would have never in a million years thought I would have joined a bank board. You know, that wasn't an interesting industry to me. It's highly regulated. But what I am interested in is what industries are being changed by the mobile internet. And digital and what's called fintech, mm-hmm. Which is all this new financial technology, everything like blockchain, Bitcoin, PayPal, Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, also banking. It's moving more online and then from the desktop to the mobile phone. I felt I could add a lot, but particularly this was they called themselves a Midwest bank, headquartered in Pittsburgh. They had great values. I really liked the management team. I really liked the board. So that's how I joined that particular board. AdKnowledge here in Kansas City, mm-hmm. private company, tech company. I was talking about digital advertising, something I'm very interested in, and quite frankly, making devices more valuable. But also, I have this sensibility about protecting privacy,
mm-hmm.
but understanding the mobile space and it being a tech company in Kansas City, I want to succeed. I like to give back to Kansas City, so I joined a local board.
You know, you've also been a huge advocate for improved digital audio quality, and on that front, you've hung out with a guy named Neil Young, who's also big on finding ways to improve sound quality. I'm a huge Neil Young fan, so come on. Give me something here. What's he like?
He's a terrific guy. So I'm sitting at home.
That's the interview. I want him here someday. I know what the odds are, but someday here. Yeah.
So I got a call on my cell phone. This is maybe 6 months ago. And hey, Dan, this is Neil Young. And the voice sounded familiar because I'm a huge collector of his music. Have been for a long time. And I'm thinking it's a high school or college buddy of mine.
Right.
You know, with a prank. But he goes, I'd really like to meet you. And it's because, in the mobile industry, he was aware and he told me of, I brought five CEOs together to create actually this phone I have in front of me, which I still carry. I never carry a cell phone for 2 years, but I've been carrying this thing for almost 2 years now.
Yeah.
Because I'm a real tech geek, where I brought the CEOs of Qualcomm, Harman, HTC, and Spotify together, of course, with myself to create this device. And he knew I was a missionary around creating better sound in mobile because like me, we're both vinyl guys, but that's not where the young generation is. That's not where they're going. How can we bring high quality sound to mobility. So that's what I tried to do with this device. And I've been, you know, I keynoted the National Music Publishers Association meeting in New York, kind of talking about that, because originally, you know, and the young generation has to take their music with you and on iPods and then on devices, because memories were small, processors were small, networks were slow. They had to greatly compress the digital sound into these things called MP3s. And they needed to do that 10 years ago. Now, with fast networks, big memories, big processors, there's no need for that. You can have uncompressed files, so these phones will play basically files for a song that are 60 times larger, and they sound a lot better.
Why aren't people more ginned up about the quality of sound? I mean, it seems to be people have just accept this lousy sound quality, and we've just gotten used to it, Dan, or where are we here?
I think so. I think people have gotten used to it in the younger generation. So actually, my son, who's in college, I've exposed him to better speakers and better headphones and better sound quality.
And
he's moving up. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now he likes to listen with the better headphones than the other headphones.
Brands. Once you go there, it's awfully hard to go back then, isn't it?
It is. And this is what, you know, what Neil Young and I spent time talking about. He sees me as another missionary, like himself. It's missionary work. It's how do we expose me coming from the tech space, also getting companies like HTC, you know, and Harman Kardon and Qualcomm to create the capabilities, because you have to build the products. And they may not come on the first gen, but I think they eventually will. It's like high-definition television. I was really happy with my Sony Trinitron television. I thought it was the best thing since sliced bread, until I walked into a Best Buy and I saw it side-by-side with high-definition, which was just coming out. And I go, that's better.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to do with music. We have to expose them to what really good sound is. And I think it'll take time, but we'll get there.
So have you been to Neil's Ranch?
I haven't. Actually, what he invited me to do, he goes, you know, I'd like to come to Kansas City and visit you.
Did he say that?
He did.
Would you bring him in here? I'm going to commitment before you walk out the door, you're bringing him in here.
I don't know, because actually we already met. He goes, I'm playing up in Chicago at Farm Aid in a couple of weeks.
Why don't you come? I saw the Farm Aid here a few years ago. Yeah.
You want to come out and hang out with me for the day? So I hung out in his private motorhome with he and Daryl Hannah.
Really?
Yeah, and we ate and talked and we all day, and it was, you know, then we would go on the side of the stage to watch Willie Nelson and John Mellencamp and Dave Matthews.
It's a great life, Dan.
And of course, Neil. Yeah. It was a fantastic day. Yeah. And I've kept in touch with him, and it's basically our shared passion is high quality sound, high quality music, and how do we take it mainstream?
Well, I'll carry your suitcase next time you go out to hang out with Neil Young for a day. Dan Hesse, former Sprint CEO, what a pleasure to have you here. Come back and visit us again. I really enjoy the conversation.
I did too, Steve. Thanks so much.